Well, the promised time has arrived. We all have been extremely lucky to have heard such an interesting and educational and important set of talks. And we now have time to be able to take questions and, as Bob Cook said, brief commentaries from the audience. So there are two portable microphones in the back. So if you'll please raise your hand. Lisa, maybe you guys can come. Well, anyway, who has a question? Lisa, bring the mics down front so you can see people here and they can catch your eye. Yes, please, right there beside Lisa. Please identify yourself and direct your question at somebody or at the general group.
I'm Donald McNeil from the New York Times. I wonder if Dr. Lubaroff and Mr. Poole could explain what seem to be divergent views on whether or not wild birds are to blame between the FAO and the WCS.
My good friend, is this on? Yeah. My good friend and colleague Hans Wagner, he is a veterinarian. Scientists, you know, we usually ask for that politics be based on good science and therefore good decision making. But you must also recognize that different scientists do have diverging points of view. The fact that perhaps Colin and I probably shared the same view on the role of wildlife, and I think the quote that he referred to earlier in his presentation was a quote actually written by me, would appear to contradict what Dr. Wagner has said. Sorry, I really do not have an explanation. We have one series of studies done during the 1983 and 84 outbreak in here in Pennsylvania in the Del Mar area, where ducks were responsible and they were carrying a highly pathogenic avian influenza in the North America setting. So we've learned from that experience. Can that be applied for elsewhere? Are we transposing what we learn in temperate climates to Southeast Asia? Well, I'm sure there's a bias there. But more studies, and I agree with Colin, more studies can be done.
Carl? Yeah, I should just add that that is a quote taken from the Cambodian media, how accurate it is. I don't know whether he was echoing the Cambodian government or they were echoing him in what they said. I could have put that same quote down to the Cambodian government. It was a bit ambiguous, so I wouldn't want that to be directly attributed to him if there's some question over that.
I'll ask.
Thank you. Back over here, please.
Hi, I'm Billy Karish from the Wildlife Conservation Society, and I'm taking great joy in helping to invite your speakers and now putting you on the spot with these questions. There's the issue about legal mandates of organizations such as CDC and WHO and FAO and where your level of responsibility lies and where you actually have a legal authority around the world. And this is kind of a general question to all of you, but I think for Dr. Lubaroff, I'll end up hoping you'll answer more specifically. But when we were having problems with the Thai ministry saying, cull all wild birds, I did send out an email to many colleagues in different organizations to say, what can we do about this? It doesn't make any sense. And a lot of organizations, governmental and multilateral organizations, said, well, it's not in our mandate, it's none of our business. But you at WHO picked up on that and within a few days sent out that press release saying, killing wild birds doesn't make sense. So how did FAO step outside its bounds? I mean, I'm at an NGO and we do it all the time and it's great fun. And sometimes we get in a little trouble, but that's okay. But how does FAO do that?
When I talked about, let me explain a little bit of our mandate. We are not, and we talked a little bit about timeliness and transparency and coming up with the information and having countries meet their international obligations as far as disease reporting to the International Office of Epizootics. But it's very clear to me those countries that are withholding information and those that are not. I'm not a police organization. I could not go to country X and ask them to that they must report or else. There's no or else. I'm not able to give any fines to countries who are not in doing what they should, said that they were going to do. So that's beyond my mandate. Directly to what you said about our press release and the wildlife, again, it was that press release, the words were chosen very, very carefully, and in that it was done in such general terms that I was not pinpointing the Thai government or any other government. So I was looking at the science from the technical department that I represent. And again, it was my science, not maybe somebody else's science, perhaps. And actually, WCS supported me on that. So because it was science-based and I represent the United Nations, I had to be diplomatic in that. So it was a general statement, and that's for maybe it was more acceptable and not necessarily out of my mandate to do so. One thing that I would like to add, I have great, or at least I was very impressed with WHO of the way they pressed China and SARS in 2003. But I'm also told, and I'd like to hear from Dr. Maslin, I understand that such repetition of WHO's strength will likely not be able to be repeated.
What I hope we will be able to do it again. In relation with the mandate and WHO taking a stand on an issue which doesn't seem to be directly related to public health, well, you need to know that in very frequently we are asked those questions by the countries themselves. Please, WHO, tell us what you advise us to do in relation with, for example, SARS in Hong Kong and the suspicion that cats and dogs might have been involved in the transmission in a particular setting. Well, we had to say something. So we scratched our heads and said something. We had to say something about avian flu, highly pathogenic, and cats, felines, whether domestic cats or cage zoo animals in Thailand again. And so we are asked, and we do say things based on, well, as much evidence as we can gather when we ask to. So we've done this for SARS, avian flu. Suddenly, the civet cats in China, we missed the point because we were not asked. And when we wanted to express our opinion, it was too late. The Chinese authorities had decided to kill, as a kind of an example of what they were able to do in a short time, had decided to kill 10,000 of these palm civet cats. And we were against it, but we couldn't do anything because it went very, very, very fast.
Okay, thank you. Someone else here, down in the front, please, this gentleman here.
Hi, Brian Cherry from the New York State Health Department. I had a question relating to reassortment. Several of our speakers talked about reassortment. In particular, I'm curious about the current state of knowledge of the evidence for the species for reassortment. We've long considered the swine population to be the sort of reassortment vet, if you will, for the avian viruses, the human viruses. They come together, they reassort. All of our first three speakers mentioned the potential for reassortment within humans. Do we have evidence for that? Do we know where that stands with other species as well as with humans?
Probably, if I can jump in. Probably reassortment occurs all the time, occurs every day, every week, every month, period. However, whatever the outcome of that new virus or that mutation, well, reassortment, let's keep it to reassortment and not mutation. The outcome probably is also low path, either for maybe low virulence or avirulence. Once in a while, something pops up, and we don't have a good indication of those virulence genes in certain species. So your question is actually very good, and I don't know the answer. Maybe.
Dr. Mesla, I think you called them reassortment vessels.
Yeah, well, I'm not a automyxoviruses specialist, but dealing with the problem, our specialists, the virologists dealing with this issue, are considering this very seriously and very lightly. Unfortunately, we have to base our decision on the advice that they provide our organization with. And I think that there is a lot of evidence that, first, it happens all the time. Second, that in the field of influenza, this has happened before, the reassorting of viruses. So it's one of these scientific opinion that in which we follow.
Yeah, please.
In terms of influenza viruses in general, species jumping capability was demonstrated earlier this year in a racing greyhounds where equine influenza was thought to have caused an outbreak of influenza and subsequent death in a kennel of greyhounds associated in the same facility. So your question is a good one, and we certainly have evidence that this flu is capable of species jumping.
Thank you. I think also one has to think about the habits of pigs and the way that they're maintained and ask a question, too, about the ecology of being a pig as well as epidemiology of being a pig. Right, gentlemen, right here. Front.
Thank you for this excellent discussion. My name is Ian Weatherly. I'm a veterinarian in private practice. The concept of culling means killing. And very often, I think the human and emotional side of that comes into play with very great importance for protecting the rest of the population from disease. I'll cite a quick example where the draconian effect of culling meant that a local zoo to which I give service had an absolutely delightful river otter. He was charming, thoroughly loved. But one of the young interns got nipped by him. When I heard about that and when the reports went in, it seemed that the state insisted that this animal be put to sleep and tested for rabies, even though it had vaccinated several times. Very draconian. And it meant that those members of that zoo would never tell me problems about being bitten. In the outbreak of foot and mouth disease, I had friends in England call me up to tell me that they were worried about calling the vet because they had a sick cow. Did I think it could be foot and mouth? This means that sometimes in the maintenance of animals, there's a reluctance to come forward with the illnesses. And secondly, one of the things that holds people back is that the laws are so draconian, and sometimes the compensation is very limited. So I wanted to ask you all whether you feel there is a sensitivity amongst different governments in different parts of the world, different agencies, about being sensible about culling and providing proper compensation to those who've had their flocks or cattle or sheep destroyed. Thank you.
Respond to that. I think you are right in saying that different governments take different attitudes. As I mentioned in my presentation just now, I think the Singapore government takes a very draconian attitude towards culling. I think this problem can be overcome if there is cooperation among countries and where certain countries can set certain guidelines upon which governments can harmonize their stand. In the ASEAN countries, ASEAN stands for the Association of Southeast Asian Countries. There are 10 of these countries comprising Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, and 3 other countries. Because of the dire economic consequences, they have come together, the health ministers have come together, and they have laid down certain policies and guidelines. And I think where you have a particular organization which lays down certain guidelines, and there should also be dialogues with international organizations In other words, the whole world, one health. And if certain guidelines are laid down, perhaps this could overcome the problem of individual governments either taking too draconian an attitude or too lax an attitude.
I would just like to add, and I hope that Dr. Lubroth would jump in. I think that the struggle is characterized by the intense focus on subjective vaccination for avian influenza. If, you know, the only other strategy is from culling is vaccination, there's merits and disadvantages to vaccination, but that's the focus of intense interest around the world, and many people are being brought together to struggle with that issue because of, you know, a lot of what you're saying. Aside from the economic losses, you know, vaccination could be an alternative to this.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, this back over here. Lisa, well back to, up to your right. Thank you.
Okay, can I respond to what a friend said about vaccination? In fact, this question was considered in the context of Malaysia and also Thailand. But the answer was, no, it's not possible to vaccinate these chickens for export because no country will buy in any case. The EU countries will not buy vaccinated chickens. So although this can be an alternative, I don't think it's a viable alternative because of the psychology behind
okay.
it.
Thank
can I just
you.
Add something here as well? Again, I mean, I think the issue of compensation is an issue. Many of the countries we're dealing with, the government's unable to compensate the farmers. The Cambodian doesn't have government doesn't have the resources to compensate farmers whose chickens have to be culled. It's not possible. They don't have those resources. So they'd be looking to international organisations to provide that compensation. But I think the idea that a lot of the actual governments themselves can do these things is just not practical.
May I just add something to that? So far as Singapore is concerned, at the height of SARS, the Singapore government had to close down certain wet markets. And the government did compensate the stallholders who lost their livelihood during that particular period. So as far as Singapore is concerned, the government has tried very hard to compensate people for loss of livelihood.
Thank you. Let's take the next question, please.
I'm Inesh Krizorsman. I'm a PhD student, and my question was related to education. A lot of you spoke about education of the general population. From what I get, it implicates drastic changes in culture and things that people do every day. And I would like to know what are the efforts being done towards this education of the general population, namely for children, because I remember that in the country where I am from, Portugal, when it was to teach people about recycling, the teaching of young children was very important because that came towards, they went home and they teach their parents and so on, and most of these children went to school, so it would be an easy access to information. And basically, I wanted to know what are the efforts of this education of the population.
Could you specify education in terms of what?
Of to stop the killing, for instance, it was mentioned that focused education should be done, and to explain to people what are the implications of wildlife and conservation, because my guess is that most people are not aware.
Colin, why don't you go ahead?
I think in terms of focus on avian influenza, very little thus far. It's something that's just come at us, as it were. We weren't expecting as conservationists. So it's not part of our sort of planned, you know, it's not part of the environmental education curriculum. It's not in there. And the immediate response is stop the killing, which is dealing with more with decision makers immediately. And then thinking long-term about, okay, how do we work through long-term education processes with children and schools about these issues? But the most immediate reaction is trying to educate decision-makers and trying to get to the media, because the media has been, one of the biggest scaremongers in this. I mean, you saw the newspaper headlines from Singapore that Professor Koh showed. I've been trying to talk to journalists locally, regionally, about some of these issues. I think that's the most powerful way immediately we can deal with these things.
I think there should be capacity building of all stakeholders at all levels, from politicians to the media to also the farmers for good management, for good husbandry management. This is really very important, and I think this is the crux of trying to solve the problem.
Thank you. We'll take the last question, this gentleman over here.
He was actually helping me get your attention. Mark Recapuano at CDC. I think the panel discussion and the presentations today fully have underscored how important multi-sectoral participation is on good, valid decision-making based on data in this arena. And there's also been a long track record of sectors not having, in the past, laid that groundwork to actually have good dialogue, communication, sharing of information, and coming together in decision-making avenues. And I wondered, given the panel with the multiple sectors that are represented there, I guess we're absent commerce, but another important sector in this, what your comments would be on what is needed at the international level, which many of you are at, but also at national level, and actually setting up models where multiple sectors do come together to actually address both the prevention of disease in these different populations and the control and response.
So the question is, what is needed to, if you
to
could...
To really get the these different sectors, human health, animal health, both from food animal, from wildlife, commerce,
okay,
coming together, having meaningful sharing of information and dialogue and playing a role together in decision making.
If you permit me. In the field of zoonosis control and even before SARS, before the Asian H5N1 avian influenza outbreak, WHO was promoting collaboration between sectors. At that time, we were especially promoting at national level collaboration between the public health and the veterinary sector for zoonotic control. That what we have understood and what we are doing today goes beyond this, because we have understood that there are more stakeholders than the physicians and the veterinarians in any one place, including here, and that we have to bring this group dealing with conservation issues and with many other issues. So we are expanding our recommendations, which has been there for quite some time.
Down the line?
Just briefly, yes, please.
Okay. From my perspective, is that we get all this excitement when the outbreak is, but what happens when there's not the outbreak? So where does this virus or viruses or bacteria, whatever, what happens during the inter-epidemics? Because that's, I think, would be most interesting in the most ecological approach, to be able to understand the behavior of the agent in a normal context of its sylvatic cycle, and then be able to at least have better intervention measures at that level and not wait till the disease goes to 14 different countries in an area. And so that's my fascination as a biologist and working as emergency prevention system at FAO, is looking at these agents during the quiet times. I think a targeted approach.
Speaking from the perspective of a human health agency, we recognize more and more the importance of reaching out to our animal health partners, whether that's international organizations such as OIE and FAO, or even within our own borders, the importance of reaching out to our state animal agriculture veterinarians and forming alliances with them. It doesn't necessarily have to be problems just in a foreign country between the Ministry of Agriculture and the Ministry of Health. We need to do this within our own states. And so we recognize that, I think, more and more at CDC, and welcome the opportunities to work with our international partners and also with wildlife organizations such as Wildlife Conservation Society, which for CDC have not been the traditional partners, but we're formalizing our relationships to be able to work together in field stations around the world where samples can be collected that will both benefit conservation of species and promote public health.
I think it is very true that it always takes a big disaster for people to act. And let this be a lesson, and I think the lesson to be learned here is to take a proactive approach rather than a reactive approach to things.
I think from my perspective, just having been involved in this panel and this day today, sitting with people like this, I mean, I've already, in my mind, I've seen, well, it's really interesting things we can do here together. You know, I've got a huge amount of access, a huge amount of data here, which we could really work together with to do something really useful with. I can just see endless possibilities here, and I'm quite keen to keep taking it forward. This is step one for me.
Thank you very much. That was the perfect way to end this morning's session. before you leave, Dr. Cook has a few comments, but before he does, if we could thank all of the speakers for their excellent presentation.
I too would like to thank the speakers. It's really been, well, Colin, you made me very happy. Just what I wanted to hear, and everyone did an exceptional job. My thanks also to Kent Redford as the moderator. He actually stepped in for us very late in the going and did a superb job. There will be a refreshment break now for, we're getting back together around 11:15, so have your cup of coffee and whatever else you need to do. Can I see the chronic wasting disease speakers up front now?